Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary from Republican Representative Adam Kinzinger of Illinois, Art Sear of Carthage College, and Robert Pape from the University of Chicago. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, where our phone lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, our email address, btb@museum.tv. And if you'd like to join us on the World Wide Web, www.beyondthebeltway.com. Well, for the next couple of hours, we're going to be talking about U.S. involvement in Libya. In a sign of U.S. confidence that the week-long assault on Libya has turned Muammar Gaddafi's air defenses, the Pentagon has reduced the amount of naval firepower arrayed against him. That was announced, not officially announced, but leaked this afternoon. The move reinforces the White House message of a diminishing U.S. role. That is a central point in President Barack Obama's national address expected tomorrow night. Today, Hillary Clinton and Robert Gates were on all the Sunday shows, basically sending the message that, this is not going to be a long engagement. We've got great panel members this evening. I want to get the reaction, first of all, from Congressman Adam Kinzinger, who is one of the new members of the House of Representatives. He's one of the youngest members of Congress. And first of all, Congressman, I want to thank you for keeping your campaign promise. We interviewed you when you were a challenger, and you won your challenge, and you kept your promise to come back to Beyond the Beltway. So thank you very much.
Thank you. It's great to be back with you.
Good. Now, the question is, you are, by the way, you were a pilot, U.S. Air Force Reserve pilot. So you've flown the big planes.
Right.
Is it wise now to pull back on the show of force that we've shown?
You know, I think what's important is that, look, we're involved in Afghanistan, Iraq, and in other areas that, you know, in many cases we don't talk about. I think it's important to try to put a Middle East face on it, to put a European face on this. Where I get concerned, and it's okay if we pull back our air assets as long as there's air assets that can come in and continue to follow through on this mission. My concern is whenever we get away from the United States being involved in the command and control part of this. This is something that we do better than any country in the world, is our ability to figure out what we need to do, when we need to do it, and have a unified chain of command. So if we begin to pull back our involvement and it's adequately taken care of by, you know, in some cases, Europeans or other Middle East allies, that's a good thing. But again, I always have a concern about that command and control side of it.
Joining us now from the University of Chicago is Professor Robert Pape. He is author of the book Bombing to Win, Air Power and Coercion in War, amongst many books that he's written, but he's one of the country's leading experts on air power. Your answer to the same question, Bob.
I think the first week has been a stunning success. It's been a success for the United States, and most importantly, it's been a success for the Libyan people. Literally just a week ago, Gaddafi's heavy forces were barreling down on Benghazi and nearly 2 million people in the east. This was a large segment of Libya's population that had broken away from the regime, and Gaddafi had vowed revenge. He vowed he would show no mercy and no pity. Every reason to expect we were within days of essentially a bloodbath in Benghazi. What's happened in the last week? We haven't just simply protected Benghazi, but we've turned the tables. Gaddafi's forces are now retreating. They're retreating now numerous times. And in fact, it looks like we have strengthened the Libyan people to the point where we can actually begin to reduce our military commitment. We still have a long way to go, but rarely have we seen such a major success that has helped so many lives in such a short time.
Art Sear from Carthage College also joins us, frequent guest on this program. Art, you have frequently been a critic of this administration and some of the mixed communications, some of the mixed signals that they send, either that between what the president is saying and what the Secretary of State is saying. Are you satisfied that they're all on the same page on this particular matter?
Yes, I've been very impressed by the coherence of the administration speaking with one voice, whatever the unattributed reports of conflict. It's important to keep in mind that Gaddafi has a great deal of blood on his hands, even by the standards of ugly Middle East and North African dictators, including American blood. He also was extremely active in earlier periods in recruiting mercenaries, a number of whom, I'm sorry to say, were disaffected U.S. special operations types and Green Berets, who were paid a great deal of money to train his military and train terrorists. I think if we could get rid of him, it would be a real plus. It also reinforces alliance relations. My favorite quote from the quotable Winston Churchill is, "The only thing worse than fighting with allies is not having any allies at all." And it's important for us to get along with our British and French friends who've been with us through the American Revolution, not always easily or on a friendly basis. But the fact that we're working with allies, I think, is a major plus.
Share with us, Congressman, your concerns about the U.S. leadership role and how NATO merges itself into the leadership of this effort.
Well, it's always
the pluses and minuses of it.
Yeah, you know, the pluses of having NATO in this is, again, there's a perception, even though I don't believe it's true, there's a perception that America has been going it alone in the Middle East. And again, it's not true. You look at our alliances we have in Afghanistan now, and it really is an international alliance. And you look at what we had in Iraq, and we had a huge group of nations that were involved in ousting Saddam Hussein. But there is that impression that it's an American face. And so I think bringing in NATO, and in many cases bringing in United Arab Emirates, Qatar, and stuff like that, to be involved in this really shows that this is a united world that's ready to do it. I think a thing to keep in mind, too, is had Gaddafi been allowed to destroy this opposition, had he been allowed to roll the tanks in and destroy this, I don't think you would have seen an uprising in Libya probably in our generation. He would be allowed to live the rest of his natural life because nobody would have the courage to stand up to him again. So we are sending a very strong message here that, you know, revolution, people standing up for freedom and democracy like we've seen in Egypt, and it appears maybe successfully, is a good thing that we're behind.
What signal are we sending in Syria?
We're sending a signal that the United States and much of the world is having a brand new relationship with the Arab street. For decades, the United States has been accused, in some cases wrongly, but in some cases rightly, of backing authoritarian regimes that wanted to maintain their power at the expense of literally tens of millions of Arabs. And this has cost us dearly. This has, in fact, been one of Osama bin Laden's rallying cries to recruit terrorists to attack us. What has happened with President Obama is suddenly, within just a period of months, the United States and actually much of the rest of the world now has a new relationship with already much of the Arab world, certainly with Egypt, certainly with Tunisia. And is it no surprise that Assad in Syria is now saying he's about to make a major speech on reforms? I don't think so.
Art Sear, your view on Assad. And I guess the broader question here would be, in recent years, Muammar Gaddafi, at least it was reported, he was giving up his weapons of mass destruction.
Yes,
he was doing the things that the United States asked him to do. So if you're a despot and you do what the United States asks you to do, and then your people rile up, I mean, why should any other despot do what the United States asks them to do if this is the way we're treating Gaddafi? That's the question. We want to get your response and get everybody's response at 1-800-723-8289. Bruce Dumont back. Thanks very much for joining us. Before the break, I asked Art Sear the question. Muammar Gaddafi in recent years had given up weapons of mass destruction, mm-hmm. which we in the United States viewed as a positive sign. And now he gets in trouble, and now we're turning on him. What signal is that sending to other despots around the world who we are trying to convince to give up their weapons and become more pro-West? Why should they do it?
Well, I don't think he was giving up I don't think the people are rising up because he was giving up WMD. I think to some extent it was a reflection of the American invasion of Iraq, in this case a positive benefit. In the case of Syria, the Israeli strike on the nuclear facility, which the North Koreans were supporting, I think was a major post-Cold War military success. And U.S. officials were able to brief the press when we finally decided to go public in such detail that it was clear that it was an American-Israeli cooperative effort that was highly successful. these kinds of things haven't prejudiced or biased or apparently restricted this popular uprising, which is of profound historical importance. We Americans tend to think everything's a reflection of us and our actions. There's a hell of a lot going on in the world that's not directly related to American foreign policy.
Let's talk about this popular uprising. Mm-hmm. How does the popular uprising in Libya, how does it differ from what's happening in Tunisia and
in
Egypt?
Good question.
The biggest difference is the cohesion of the military. In Egypt and Tunisia, the military was cohesive and on the side of the popular revolution. And that's why what you saw was the very senior leaders had really no choice but to actually give in and begin to make reforms. In the case of Libya, what you saw is actually fragmentation. So Libya is a country that's about twice the size of Texas, 6.5 million people, but they all tend to live in about a dozen cities to the coast, clustered in the west and the east. What exactly happened is those cities fragmented. That is, the popular revolution came, and about 75% of the population broke away, probably about a third, if
and
not
Libya,
more.
And Libya, again, a fairly large country in the Middle East.
It's a large country in the Middle East.
If we're to look at the map,
but it's
right.
If you look at the map, but it's mostly a giant sea of sand with people living in just a handful of cities. Think of those as islands to the north in this giant sea. So what happened here was that the military actually fragmented. So all the military in the east, where there are about 2 million people who live, a third of the country, broke away with the population. And then in the west, near Tripoli, it was split about half and half. So Gaddafi still has a very significant military force, but the military itself fragmented, and that's why we have a very different outcome.
Congressman, I want to ask you a personal question and a political question. Your background is you signed up for the U.S. Air Force after the attack on 9/11.
Right.
You're a patriot. You've been elected to Congress. You've been elected to Congress, at least according to the popular pundits, primarily because of speaking about economic issues. You were a very popular candidate of the Tea Party movement, Sarah Palin. They supported you in your primary. And in the general election. When you now go to Washington, and the message that sent you there was primarily one of economics, cut, 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 cut. And now you have the power as a member of the United States Congress. You've got the message from back home to cut, 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 economic issues. And yet you have right before you, on your watch, you have one of the most significant political revolutions in the history of the world that's happening on your watch, and all of those things are costing the United States money. How do you sell this story? How do you tell this story to the people who like you, they respect you, they want you to go cut, 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 but there's a real world that
right.
They may not be ready to accept.
Right. You know, the reality of it is we do have to cut. I mean, we can get into all those issues in a bit. We have to cut. We have to grow the economy. But the most important job of the federal government, we can't put up the walls here and pretend like America can just kind of hide in the corner and the rest of the world doesn't exist. The most important job of the federal government is defense of the country. And when you look at a popular uprising like in Libya and you see the opportunity for the headache that the Middle East has been for us, and frankly, the fact that we do rely on the Middle East for a lot of our resources and oil and things like that, and you see an opportunity for democracy to rise up, and you see a human tragedy happening, and you know that we could be on the side, and we should be on the side of democracy and freedom, that could prevent, frankly, if you look at it a couple processes down, that could prevent another 9/11 on our soil. I think the important thing to remember, the biggest disinfectant to terrorism, and look, we understand that we're a country at threat with terrorism. The biggest disinfectant to terrorism is freedom and liberty. When people taste freedom and they taste liberty and they understand what economic freedom is, they turn against terrorism. It's when they're kept in a corner and they're told, look at how evil the United States is. They're the reason you're at fault. Nothing's ever going to be good as long as they're around, that they can be turned into terrorists and come to our shore. So,
do you believe that the rebels in Libya, do they have a thirst for democracy, or do they just want to throw off the chains of the repression that they know? I mean, are they thinking of things in your mind in the bigger, broader world of democracy?
I don't know. Freedom? I don't know. And that's a good question. And I think that's one of the things we're dealing with is what is this going to turn into? Who's in charge? What's it really going to roll into? But I do know that the people have stood up and said they're tired of living under a despot. They're tired of living in that kind of a system. And so they've stood up. And I think whether they call it democracy or what they call it, it's freedom. Every human at the very base of who they are, they want freedom. They want the ability to choose their own destiny. And so if this is exactly what they're – if they're thinking in terms of how we're talking, I don't know. But I know that they want freedom.
Bob, what do you think?
I think the congressman is exactly right on both points. I think everything that's been coming out of the rebels is they're grateful for the West. They understand the West and the United States, the world's largest and most important democracy, is giving them a chance at real freedom. That's all the rhetoric that we see coming out of the people in Benghazi, for instance. And I think the congressman's right. This is a real opportunity. I also think the congressman's right that this is a true blow to Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda. What's happening in Northern Africa is the biggest blow to al-Qaeda since the Taliban fell in 2001. Northern Africa was one of the areas bin Laden was able to recruit and do a good job recruiting. He recruited hundreds of terrorists from that area. Why? He made the argument in that Tunisia, Egypt, Libya, that these were actually American and Western-backed repressive regimes. The more we bought Gaddafi's oil, the more we put money in his pocket to repress his people. Bin Laden used that rhetoric against us. He can't anymore.
Art Sear, where do you come down on this, the continued expansion and what the true motives of the rebels are? Do you have any fear at all that we will wake up 2 years, 3 years, 4 years from now and say, oh, my golly, why did we let these rebels in? We knew Gaddafi was a bad guy, but he was a bad guy at least that we had some control over. And now look what's happened.
I agree with.
They've thrown him over, and what has replaced him is worse. Are you worried about that?
Sure, and I'm sure your other two guests are as well, but I agree with both these articulate gentlemen that we should be hopeful, again, reference to the American Revolution and our basic principles. It's very possible, given the lack of democratic tradition in Libya and elsewhere, that some different new sorts of unsavory elements may come to the fore, including those who are friendly to al-Qaeda. But that's no reason for us to veto this. I would bet, if I were a betting man, on Egypt most of all. Their ties with the West are the strongest.
Mm-hmm.
Going back to the Eisenhower administration, when Ike quite wisely vetoed a British-French-Israeli invasion of the Sinai and a retake of the Suez Canal, Egypt has the most stable and pro-Western military. President Kennedy and Gamal Nasser had a very extensive personal correspondence, and Kennedy, after the 64 election, assuming he was returned to the White House, was planning to face the Israel lobby and have Nasser visit the U.S. I would bet on Egypt, speaking historically, but you're right, this is very unpredictable.
Let's go to calls. Let's go to Kevin, listening to us in Temple, Texas on KLBJ. Got a good question. Go ahead.
Well, my main thrust is, there are a lot of humanitarian problems that we could get involved in all around the world where people, mm-hmm. dictators that we have supported are slaughtering their own people. Think of Ivory Coast, think of Yemen, think of Bahrain, think of other places, yet we don't get involved. So are we going to just – have we just decided as a nation to let the president – involved in these things on his whim, and then we will just support them?
Let's let the congressman respond to that.
I think that's a great question. Look, in the reality of the world, there's a lot of bad stuff going on. I mean, you look at massacres in Africa. You look at what's going on in the Middle East all over the place. We don't have the ability, nor do I think we should, get involved in every one of those. But the key here is we have an opportunity. Libya is, frankly, right by Europe. It's convenient in location. But we have an opportunity to allow freedom to rise, to allow freedom to throw out a despot that has killed Americans. That's another key point in the past. I mean, he's blown up a Pan Am flight, you know, killed Americans in a disco. He has literally, as was said earlier, American blood on his hands. And we were sitting on the edge of a massacre of epic proportions that I think had we not gotten engaged, had we not gotten involved, we would look back in 2 years with shame at the fact that we didn't do it.
No, I don't think so, because I think there the people in this country don't understand what conditions that most of the people in the rest of the world live under. And we can't solve them all. We're never going to be able to solve them all. And this tension on the part of this current administration and everybody else involved in Congress to just say, well, we're involved now, so we got to support
Kevin, would you understand though that at least one thing that might make this situation a little bit different. Again, this is the guy that orchestrated the shoot down of Lockerbie. I mean, this was a passenger plane. And by the
way,
Bob Pate's got a question for you. He wants to respond. Stay on the line. We're going to put you on hold. Bob Pate wants to get respond to you as well, and we'll do that when we come back from Chicago. From Youngstown, Ohio to Temple, Texas, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway on America's Great Talk radio stations, as well as Sirius and XM Satellite Radio. Our guests this evening include Art Sear. He is the A.W. Clawson Professor at Carthage College in Kenosha, Wisconsin, author of the book After the Cold War. Bob Pate also joins us. He is with the University of Chicago. He's a professor of political science, and he heads their center on terrorism and
security,
and also has written numerous books, including the latest one is
Cutting the Fuse, The Explosion of Global Suicide Terrorism and How to Stop It.
And you also wrote Dying to Win, The Strategic Logic of Suicide Terrorism, and Bombing to Win, Air Power and Coercion in War. And before coming to the University of Chicago, you taught at Dartmouth. We're on in Hanover, New Hampshire, so we got a lot of people from Dartmouth listening to the broadcast this evening, and also 5 years at the U.S. Air Force School of Advanced Air Power Studies, again, one of the country's leading experts on air power. And Adam Kinzinger joins us. He is a Republican from the 11th District of Illinois. That's in suburban and rural western Illinois, and he is a member of the Energy and Commerce Committee. He is one of the new Republicans sent by the his constituents and a lot of Tea Party supporters back home. He ended up in leadership. He ended up on the transition team, which was quite a bouquet of appreciation for your confidence. And also, you're now a deputy Republican whip. And again, as a member of the Energy and Commerce Committee, we should mention that back home in the 11th District, it is home to three nuclear power plants, windmills, hydroelectric plants, quite a power source, if you will.
And oil refineries.
So I want to just take a few minutes to diversion of our discussion of what's happening in Libya to get your response to what has happened in Japan and the growing concern worldwide over nuclear safety.
Yeah, you know, I'm very concerned about what's happening. I think it's important to take an early peek at what happened, try to figure out what went wrong, and then when it's all done and settled down, and we hope it's settled down soon, kind of do a forensic look at what went wrong. You know, I think the key to remember, what it appears is that the plant survived the earthquake, the 9.0 earthquake. In my district, I have three plants. Is it possible that Illinois could get a 9.0 earthquake? It is. But they survived that. What they didn't survive was the follow-on wall of water that came in and the tsunami that took out the backup generators and prevented them the ability to cool the reactor. So I think it's important, you know, coastal plants, let's take a look at where they're susceptible to tsunamis. Do we need to raise the generators higher? Do we need to raise defense walls higher? What does that need to take care of? And then in the Midwest and in areas that are in the interior, what do we need to do? The key here, though, is to be very careful to throw the baby out with the bathwater. You have a lot of folks that are anti-nuclear, that have been anti-nuclear for 30 years, activists, that are seizing on this opportunity to be the moment where they can bring down nuclear power. United States gets 20% of its power from nuclear, and I think if we believe in clean energy, which I do, I would love to eventually get to the point of having all clean energy, nuclear is going to play an important role in that. So we can't throw the baby out here with the bathwater.
And we should also mention that during the presidential campaign, one strong point of what Barack Obama had to say is Barack Obama is a supporter of expanded nuclear power.
Yeah, that's right. That's
right.
So
we'll see whether he follows through on that. Obviously, the oil spill, the BP oil spill, quickly turned him and away from the idea of offshore drilling. But let's see what the reaction is now. Art?
John, in fairness, John McCain is also a very strong advocate of nuclear power, and it was not a point of disagreement during the campaign because they were both on the same page.
Right. Let us go back to Kevin, who was in Temple, Texas. Kevin, are you still there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, Bob Pate from the University of Chicago wants to respond, and then we'll give you the last word. Bob?
I think Kevin has put his finger on what's going to be a major issue in our country going forward, which is, does Libya set a dangerous precedent whereby we're going to now find ourselves intervening all over the world in numerous humanitarian crises? I think Libya has set a precedent, but I don't think it's dangerous for the following reason, which is that Libya has two aspects coming together. Murderous behavior on the part of a dictator and a practical plan of action that we and much of the world could implement within just a short period of time, literally within about 10 days. It's very unusual to be able to look at two aspects, that is to have a humanitarian emergency, not just a small crisis, but an emergency that we and the rest of the world can actually do something about in a short period of time. This is really not the case in, say, Darfur and numerous other issues that people may bring up. It is very much the case that this we could do both of these in Libya, and it's good that we did.
Is part of this new opportunity, this doctrine, I want to go back. We've got at least a couple of people here at the table that are strong opponents, supporters of air power. Is this a situation where it's U.S. air power that really secures the airspace, but our policy should not involve boots on the ground? When we put boots on the ground, everyone gets fearful of another Vietnam, another Iraq. But the key here is we provide the support from high up, and we let other nations work the ground. Is that a fair way to look at what our role? So we're a policeman, but we're not the only policeman.
Well, I think that's what we're seeing now. I'm also very careful. I actually disagree with the president. I've been supportive of what we've done so far. I disagree with the fact that he very strongly said we will never put a single boot on the ground. Number one, there's an old saying, especially in military, is never say what you'll never do, because you might have to do it sometime. But beyond that, even if we internally say we're never going to put a boot on the ground, which I agree with, the problem is you take away that threat in part of the motivation of Gaddafi to get out of power. If he knows that just air power is going to be overhead, and thankfully it's working, but if he knows that, he knows he can hunker down and to some cases avoid it. If he thinks there's a chance that 18, 19, 20-year-old Marines may be kicking in his front door in his town, that's a motivator in itself. So when you take boots on the ground off of the table, I think you lose a valuable opportunity.
Kevin, last word to you, then we're moving on.
Okay, I think it's at a critical point. I think we need to decide whether we're going to be a country of laws or a country of a dictator or a king. And these are the actions of a dictator. He decided he wanted to do something, then he got his little okay slip from the UN, and then he did it. We, the people, had no say in it. Our representatives had no say. And we're the ones who are paying for it, and we're the ones who are going to be the ones dying in the event that we do have to put boots on the ground.
And so that sends us to Austin, Texas, where Jeff is listening to us on KLBJ. He picks up on that point. Go ahead, Jeff.
Yeah, my point was about Congress not debating nor being asked for their approval on this Libya action. Gentlemen, in the last 100 years, our country has lost control of its currency through the Federal Reserve. We've lost control of our presidency to the Council on Foreign Relations. And now we've lost control of our military to an unelected body called NATO that openly, admittedly, gets its orders from a Bilderberger, Henry Kissinger. Thank you very much.
Well, I would say from the Congress perspective, the president's allowed to do this through the War Powers Act. But beyond that, in many cases, and I think what we had in Libya was a situation where had we delayed, come to Congress, and I would love him to come to Congress, but had we delayed to do that, we may be sitting in, right now on top of a humanitarian disaster. On Wednesday, leadership is going to come and talk to us and brief us on what's going on. And I think that's good. It's good to come to Congress. But we also, in many cases, for something like this, limited air power, can't always just wait because we may be sitting on a larger disaster.
Sam in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, listening to us on WRNN. I guess, no, he's not there. Let's go to Dave on WAPI in Birmingham, Alabama.
Yes, I'd just like to make a couple of quick points, if I may.
Sure.
One is I keep hearing this word democracy thrown about, which is really a joke to me, I mean, we don't actually have a democracy here. And to think that there are other countries with different values that they all want democracy is just ludicrous to me. And secondly, I guess the most important thing, as President Obama, at this point, I don't have any choice, really, but to figure that he has the best interests of this country in mind. I know there are many that would disagree. I don't know, but he is the president, and so. One thing, I mean, just go back to the Civil War in this country, and even though I'm a native Alabamian, you know, it would have been a disaster if the South would have won that.
Sure, we're gonna move on. You're a little off track tonight. Let's go to Sam in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. He is back. Go ahead, Sam.
Yes, Bruce. It seems to me that Barack Obama is interested in helping anyone that is opposed to the U.S. We're already seeing in Egypt the Muslim Brotherhood is coming to the fore. And I'm just curious in asking your panel, if this is truly a citizen rebel revolt, how are they getting weapons, including planes?
Well, as I said earlier, what happened in the case of Libya is the Libyan military itself fragmented. So Libya kept a good fraction, a brigade of its military in the eastern part of the country. The entire brigade just simply broke away and joined the rebels. That's why the rebels actually have hundreds of combat vehicles. Now, they, of course, don't have a lot of spare parts and a lot of other things. So this is still, I don't mean to say an actual army, but when a military disintegrates, it is not unusual for the people, if you would, to end up with some military forces.
When we come back, I want to ask the question, what would happen if Muammar Gaddafi stepped down and turned over power to his son? Mm-hmm. How would that be viewed by the world, by the United States, and by the rebels? 1-800-723-8289. I'm Bruce Dumont.
Back.
From Austin, Texas to Ashtabula, Ohio, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. Before the break, I asked all of our guests the question, what would happen if Muammar Gaddafi stepped aside, turned over power to his son? And Bob, I want to start with you and give you a chance to sort of react to that question.
I think it's a great question, Bruce, because Saif Gaddafi is the reformer among the Gaddafis. In the last decade, it's Saif Gaddafi who's lived in London. He's gotten a degree, a PhD from the London School of Economics. For years, he had an Israeli girlfriend. If you've ever seen, viewers will just go to YouTube. They'll see many videos of Saif Gaddafi, and he's going to look like a suave Westerner. He's actually a rich playboy. Boy reformer. He's sort of like Bruce Wayne, so to speak. He's a reformer. But the fact of the matter is, and so it is imaginable that his father may try that. But the fact of the matter is that it was Saif Gaddafi himself who very early on said that he and his family were going to fight to the last bullet, that there would be rivers of blood. Well, since he said that, there have been probably somewhere between 1,500 and 2,000 Libyans murdered by the Gaddafis. So I think that had Gaddafi been smart, had the father been smart, this would have been an excellent move early on. But now that a month has gone by and now that so many, he has murdered so many, I don't think there's room here for any Gaddafi.
Look into the crystal ball, Congressman Kinzinger, what do you think? Give us your take as to where you think things end in Libya, at least in the foreseeable future.
You know, I think you're going to eventually see, and this is, I guess this would be my dream scenario, is to see the rebels continue to press west and eventually see somebody in Gaddafi's inner circle turn on him and take him out. I don't think that's beyond thinking. That's where I'd love to see it happen. I would love to see the rebel forces, you know, or potentially create a de facto government to allow democracy and freedom to come in. That's kind of what you saw in Egypt. Again, as was mentioned earlier, though, you had more of a monolithic unified military, and it was a peaceful transition. transition. But I think we have a real opportunity here to see this thing go very well. At the same time, by the same token, we have an opportunity for it not to go well. And I think that's important. And the professor's talked about it a lot. It's important that we have humanitarian assistance and Western involvement so that we can be there to help in this transition.
Art Sear, the armchair generals, who I'm sure are listening to the broadcast this evening, they say if we could just take him out, just assassinate him. Let's just assassinate Gaddafi, and the minute we assassinate him, everything is going to be better.
That would be
would
a good way. No, I don't think so. It would be a good way to turn him into a martyr. He's been playing that card as a way of trying to generate support for himself. We are trying, at least with long-range weapons, to kill targeted individuals. I think that's appropriate, but it's also against U.S. law. Gerald Ford, in the wake of some fairly shocking congressional revelations in the 70s, signed an executive order reiterated by Jimmy Carter and reiterated by Ronald Reagan, one of the first things he did, interestingly enough, that we will not engage in the assassination of foreign leaders.
That's the Bruce, the idea of assassinating Gaddafi from the air is the naive solution. It sounds good at first blush.
Didn't we kill one of his children?
We did.
We did in 1986. April 1986, we tried this. We missed Gaddafi. We killed his three-year-old daughter. And what we did is strengthen his grip on power for over 25 years. If we did this now, this is what Gaddafi's hoping for, because this would help him to bring people inside of Libya to his defense, and it would probably break the international coalition. Right now, we have the international coalition slightly growing. If we were to take this step and actually try to put the crosshairs directly on Gaddafi himself, that would probably break. Instead, what we should do is move to massive economic aid to Benghazi in the east of Libya. What this would do is tend to encourage more and more people inside of Libya itself to break away from the regime and move to support Benghazi and the east. And by the way, 80% of Libya's oil comes through Benghazi in the east. So the fact of the matter is this isn't a prescription. We don't have to face a future stalemate here. We can literally start to organize and support the new government around the rebels in Benghazi and then just let the people vote with their feet. Who would they rather be with? The free Libyans of the east or Gaddafi in the west?
What's the time frame on that?
I think that this is a matter of months. I think that it will take a period of weeks to actually move economic support. I don't really mean humanitarian aid in the sense your listeners might be used to thinking where there's refugee camps and so on. No, most people in Libya are actually still living in their homes. They have pre-existing commercial ties. 90% of Libyans buy food imported food, and that comes from Europe. So what we mainly need to do is jumpstart, reopen the pre-existing commercial lines and have all that flow massively into the east, so that people in the east will get prosperous and prosperous and prosperous.
And what do we say, Congressman, to those people who are listening to the broadcast this evening that say there is no national interest, there is no U.S. national interest in Libya?
Yeah, I think it's clear that there is U.S. national interest. Again, we can talk about historically, you know, what Gaddafi has done, and I think what he would be willing to do again, to be honest with you, especially after he crushes an uprising and he now strengthens his grip on power, and to do that, he blames the United States. I think there's an interest there, and I think there's an interest in the grander, more strategic part of the Middle East. Again, the Middle East is very important to us, and if we do not want to be embroiled into wars in the Middle East, it's good to show freedom and to have freedom rise up and to do it in a limited way of supporting it from our end than have to go in there later with boots on the ground in a massive way.
Does it, Art Sear, when we need a 30-second answer to this, is the real strategic issue perhaps a more direct link, however, to Western Europe?
Western Europe has more
of an impact?
In terms of oil, yes, but Libya has a lot more than oil. It's strategically of vital importance as a trade route. A huge amount of trade goes through the Mediterranean. It's a big reason why Hitler and before him Napoleon thought that part of the world was worth conquering.
Art Sear, thanks very much for being with us. You're going to be with us in the next hour. Bob Pate, you're going to be back for the next hour as well. Congressman Adam Kinzinger has joined us. He's got to move on. But again, thank you very much
thank
for
you.
Being here.
Great
I hope
to be
you
here.
Can come back. And
I'd
again, as
to.
As I said at the beginning of the broadcast, he made a promise to be here when we had him on when he was a candidate. And he kept his promise.
And I'm coming back again.
That's terrific. There we go. We got it on tape again. I'm Bruce Dumont again. If you're listening from coast to coast and border to border on radio, we're going to be back for another full hour. If you're watching us on television, we'll see you next week. Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with hour number two of Beyond the Beltway this evening. Tonight featuring commentary by Art Sear, the Clausen Distinguished Political Professor at Carthage College in Kenosha, Wisconsin, and Robert Pape, political science professor at the University of Chicago, and one of the country's leading experts on air power. And our program coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications, where our phone lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, btb@museum.tv. We have lots to talk about. We've just sort of scratched the surface about what is happening in Libya and what U.S. policy is and should be in Libya. The President of the United States will address the nation tomorrow evening and give clarification on what that policy is. But perhaps you saw Bob Gates and Hillary Clinton on the morning talk shows today. They were making the rounds presenting the administration position. And again, we're going to talk more about it in this hour. We have a lot of callers standing by. Let's go to Nick, listening to us in El Paso, Texas, on KTSM. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. Good evening, gentlemen.
Good evening.
Yes, Bruce. By taking this action in Libya, we are creating a world of people around the world, from Afghanistan to Iraq to Libya now, and now maybe Syria, where people feel entitled, entitlement that they get support from U.S. air power to fight their wars. They don't want to fight their war, fight their wars like in Iraq or Afghanistan or in Syria or Libya. They want us to fight them for them. Okay, we're creating a generation of people on entitlement, like the Europeans feel entitled of the U.S. military protect them for 50 years there. Now,
can I ask you just a couple of questions, and then I want to engage our guests who are in the studio with you as well. If there are people around the world who thirst for freedom, and I want to say freedom, I don't even want to say democracy, because democracy, they may not exactly know what that is, but they thirst for freedom. Congressman Kinzinger in the first hour says that he thinks that's an innate goal that people have or desire is freedom. So if there are people around the world who have that thirst, who've been living under repression, and we as a nation are holding ourselves up as the champion of freedom and have universally spoken out against repression, sometimes out of both sides of our mouth, I might add, but we have done it. When the people of a particular country rise up against their leadership at great risk, why is it so bad for the United States to use one of its strongest assets, which is its air power, to encourage those people to do what they are doing? Why is that such a bad thing?
No, Bruce, that's not a bad thing. Well, we lost the initiative there when the city was surrounded, the capital was surrounded, Tripoli. We lost the initiative, and now the people who rose up, and who are these people? Who are they aligned with? Are they aligned with Al-Qaeda and the Islamic migrant in North Africa? Just like the Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula? Who are these people aligned with? Are the Syrians going to demand air power? Bruce, when I was in the U.S. Marine in the during Operation Desert Shield, Desert Storm, after we kicked out Saddam out of Kuwait, and I was in southern Kuwait, I thought the people that we should have gave air power to were the Shiites and the Kurds in Iraq, because we asked them to rise up. And then we let them down. We let those people down. We were there. We had the military force there. We already did the U.N. mandate. We kicked Saddam out of Kuwait. We finished the job. But we should have helped those people.
Okay. Let's let Bob Pate explain what happened then, and what's happening now and engage you in the conversation, and then Art's here as well.
Well, he's made many points, but two points I think are most prominent. Number one, he's asserting that maybe these people who are rising up are al-Qaeda. I think it's important to remember that that's part of Gaddafi's propaganda. Gaddafi's the first one to say this was not a popular uprising, it's al-Qaeda. And the reason that's unlikely to be so is because for the last 40 years, Gaddafi has tried to kill virtually every Islamist he could get his hands on in his own country. So he has spent his career trying to actually kill al-Qaeda, not support it. Now, he has supported other terrorists, don't get me wrong. But al-Qaeda in particular has been often trying to kill him. So this has been a bit of a war. And so I don't think it's likely that al-Qaeda is actually working in the shadows here in Benghazi. But then the caller also asked, I think, a very good question, which is, have we created a hazard where others are going to rise up in expectation of American air power and American support? And the key point I would point out there is that there is a risk, but I think it's limited. I think the reason the risk is limited is because it's costly on the people to rise up. In the case of Libya, probably something like 2,000 people were murdered before we took action. That's a pretty heavy risk to bear if that's what it means to bring in the United States. So it doesn't mean there's no risk, but I think it's limited.
Art, I want to ask you a question, a comparison issue, because you're a great political historian. How would you compare the signal of encouragement, the protection of rebels, and the attempt to provide humanitarian support in a country where there's been widespread reports of devastation and murder and mayhem? How would you compare what we're watching now with what happened in Bosnia-Herzegovina, where the United States provided air power? There were horrible stories. Milosevic was a horrible man. Mm-hmm. Then there was a rising up against him, and we provided support against him, or we fought the war against him from 30,000 feet by dropping bombs.
That's a very interesting comparison, and
thank you.
And one hard to address briefly, especially if you're an academic.
Well, we got
in
40
the case
minutes.
you might get a little annoyed if I took the whole.
Yes, we would.
Right.
So would the callers.
Plus, a lecture takes at least 50, Bruce. Yeah. In the case of Gaddafi, we have a genuinely bad guy. The caller is right. We don't know how the revolution is going to unfold. That's in the nature of revolutions. In the case of the Balkans, I think it's very revealing concerning Americans in particular. We like good guys. We tend to divide the world into good guys and bad guys. We're all Woodrow Wilson in that sense. Milosevic was a bad guy. Karadzic, on the other side, was a bad guy. The Croatians, in fact, where the Nazis did a tremendous amount of recruiting and got ferocious military talent at their disposal, there were the sons and grandsons of the Third Reich supporters who went into battle against the Serbs wearing their Nazi uniforms and carrying Nazi flags. We didn't publicize that much because Milosevic was the bad guy. Second point, you don't win anything by air power alone. That rascal Bill Clinton repeatedly says we won the war through air power alone. That's not true. We had the Kosovo Liberation Army with us. Al-Qaeda, it's been a virulent source of recruits for Al-Qaeda, some of whom have fought in Chechnya. Whether you're dealing with Libya or dealing with the Balkans, the world's a very complicated place. I do believe, as Bob has very articulately pointed out, and so did the congressman, that in the case of Libya, there are very good grounds for us to intervene with air power. But our assets are limited. We don't have any ground forces to spare at the moment, and even our air assets are being strained.
Callers, stay on the line. We're going to give you the last word when we come back, but it's going to be after this break. From coast to coast and border to border, taking America's political pulse tonight on U.S. Libyan policy and NATO Libyan policy, I'm Bruce Dumont.
What's that?
From Spokane, Washington to Knoxville, Tennessee, you are listening to Beyond the Beltway every Sunday night. Nice to have you with us from coast to coast and border to border. Nick is listening to us in El Paso, Texas. He's been listening to the professors respond to your comments in Chicago. Nick, we're going to give you the last word.
Yes, Bruce. If the people in Syria rise up, which they are doing now and being killed, and we go up against the Syrian military, and they want airstrikes against the Syrian military, which is much better than the Libyan military. What are we going to do then? What are we going to do then? Are we going to do the same thing? Are we going to? How about across the border here, in Mexico?
Syria is a great.
I don't think Syria is a great. The answer is we're not going to do it everywhere.
I don't think we're going to do it everywhere, and I don't think it's going to be Syria for two reasons. First of all, if we look at the number dead in the first 2 weeks of the Syrian uprising and revolt, 60 people, not 600, not 2,000, 60 people have been killed. Yes, it's bad that anybody's been killed, but it's 60. The first 2 weeks of the Libyan uprising, about 2,000 were murdered. It's an order of magnitude difference, several orders of magnitude difference. In terms of how feasible it is, the caller's quite right. Feasibility is a much more difficult problem. And in fact, I think that that would give us great pause before doing it. So as I've been trying to say, I think that what we're doing, Bruce, is we're moving to a new standard of humanitarian intervention. For decades since World War II, we've talked about genocide, that if there's a mass extermination, that would be the only standard. Well, notice how we haven't actually invoked that standard and done much about some of the major genocides that have occurred in Cambodia, in Rwanda, or Darfur. Where have we actually intervened? And we've intervened successfully. We've intervened in the Balkans successfully, and we've intervened in Libya. Those cases have two things in common. Egregious murder of thousands and thousands of civilians with the likelihood of more, and secondarily, a real practical plan where we could intervene at low cost to ourselves. Why? Because we not only had air power at our disposal, but there was a significant force on the ground that we could have air power work together with. You put those two together, that is a very low cost plan and egregious murder. I believe this is now becoming the new standard for intervention.
Art, sir.
Alliance relations are also a factor. There is a UN Security Council resolution which provided legal justification and practical political justification for our intervention in Libya, along with NATO alliance support. I don't think that situation is so likely to unfold in Syria. Bob referred to genocides. We've been actually, in many ways, remarkably successful in following up even after the fact. There are UN commissions addressing war crimes in Cambodia as well as Africa, and people are very slowly being brought to justice. This doesn't justify lack of action earlier on, but I'm impressed at how important the UN has become since the end of the Cold War.
Let us go to George in Schaumburg, Illinois, on WLS. Go ahead, George.
Yeah, thank you. You know, it just seems to me this whole thing is a day late and a dollar short. You know, we're already engaged in Afghanistan, and there doesn't seem to be a clear-cut exit strategy over there. My son's in the Air Force, and he's over there. He's flying F-16s, and what I'm getting out of him from some of his working-class military types, not the top brass that are the back rooms planning all of this stuff, but the guy's actually lifting. You know, they're wondering what the end game's really going to be and why we're doing this Libyan thing. You know, our nation is in so much debt right now, and as much as we want to help good people, you know, not get killed by these bad people, where do we really draw the line? I mean, this thing is never ending, and we're focused on stuff while Rome is burning that, quite frankly, I think is insane.
The fact that Afghanistan is become one of the sores, the sucking chest wounds here of American foreign policy is true. It's happened under the Obama administration. It's happened under the Bush administration. The reason isn't because of something wrong with Bush or something wrong with Obama. The problem is in Afghanistan itself. The mission has been, certainly over the last 5 or 6 years, to nation build in Afghanistan. This is not a 3-year problem. This is not a 30-year problem. This is probably a 100-year mission. The problem in Afghanistan is that we have a goal that's probably just simply not achievable. And so the caller is right that is a major problem. But standing aside, well, tens of thousands of people are butchered in Benghazi when we could stop it with just a couple days of effort because of Afghanistan is simply not a trade-off.
Go ahead, caller.
Yeah, no, I understand your point in a couple days of work, but I think it's going to wind up being a lot more than that. And not only that, but what other destabilization will occur after the fact. Granted, Gaddafi's, you know, really a bad guy, but we don't really know, I don't think, who's going to emerge after him. And it seems to me that whenever we get in there and start diddling around with stuff, we actually create something worse than what was already there. You know, I'm not an ideologue. I'm a pragmatist. And realize we've got finite resources and can't be everything to everybody. So where do we really, you know, draw the line on this stuff?
Art Sear.
Let's let Art tackle
that one, okay?
I think the caller makes a very profound point. There was no choice about going into Afghanistan. Everything's clear in hindsight. We could have handled things differently, but given the fact that the Taliban sheltered al-Qaeda and in that sense had a direct tie-in to 9/11, I think made it essential that we intervene. And we had the UN and NATO with us. I believe the U.S. invasion of Iraq was a mistake.
I agree.
I also am very mindful of what Dwight Eisenhower warned us about, that there is a military-industrial complex which, on a regular and continuing basis, exerts enormous corporate and political pressure for military interventions around the world. The U.S. defense budget is now half the defense spending of the entire planet. Think of the kind of pressure that generates within this country and others to undertake military adventures. I also like to quote Ike that any damn fool can get into a war. What's really difficult is to get out of a war with your interests intact and defensible goals achieved. What's toughest of all is defending your national interests without going to war.
George, thanks very much for your call. Let's go to Bob in Temple, Texas. KLBJ coming in loud and clear tonight. Nice to hear from Texas.
Well, thank you very much for having me on, and I appreciate your callers, all of their pedigrees, and I'd like to involve them in answering my question. I just wanted to know if there was one real example historically that you could cite where the people of the Middle East, Arabs in origin, have actually coalesced together independently, organically, for freedom. The last gentleman answered a question about Afghanistan, saying that the goal may be a 100-year goal. It may not be reasonable for nation building. So why the optimism for Libyans in and of themselves organically, with a little bit of guidance, becoming the first democracy in Middle Eastern history? Or is it more likely that they rebuild the mosque?
Well, do you think bigger
than ever?
Do you think it will be? I mean, you're talking about Libya being the first. I might argue that maybe it's going to be Egypt or Tunisia first. I mean, if we're looking at
there is a model. Well, sir, there's optimism for this, and everyone's quick to say, oh, maybe it's going to be Egypt. Where it's Libya.
Well,
we've tried to impose it in Afghanistan and Iraq, and it's tenuous at best.
We already have one in Turkey. We have a functioning democracy in Turkey.
Right. Turkey.
Please.
Why don't you credit Turkey? 72 million people. They hold regular elections. In fact, they are increasingly, one of the shining examples. So, I've just been to Turkey actually just 3 weeks ago. I've been there twice in the last year. This is a real functioning democracy. They're about to have a new election in June, which is going to probably produce 80% turnout.
Caller, are you there? Well, the caller is gone.
Yeah. Well, but let me just simply say that
one size does not fit all.
No.
No.
But
exactly.
But the caller is saying is it seems to me that with Afghanistan, I don't think there's this thirst for freedom that Congressman Kinzinger was talking about. In Iraq, I think we've seen at least a positive sign with the way in which they have voted. They all went out and voted, got their little purple thumbs.
Right.
And now we're dealing with rebellions from the street, which is some indication that the folks are not happy with their leadership.
The real issue, of course, the caller is putting his finger on something, and then he probably made just too strong of a case. Yes, we have Turkey, but the real issue here is, given the problems with going forward in democracy, should we actively suppress it? That's really the issue. Because if it's a problem having democracy, because it's just going to be too messy for 10 or 20 years, then what we really want are brutal dictators like Gaddafi, because they really will prevent that from happening for real. And I just think this is a wrong choice. This is the wrong side of history for us to be on. But that's a choice that we were forced to make in the last week. Gaddafi forced that choice, not us, Gaddafi. And I think we made the right choice.
You announced in the first hour that you gave a description of Saif Gaddafi, Muammar Gaddafi's son. You have been to Libya twice in the last year.
Mm-hmm.
You were invited to Libya.
Mm-hmm.
Why were you invited, and what did you see?
Yeah, I was in Libya twice in the last 18 months.
You know what? It was wrong for me to ask that question.
Ah.
It was a brilliant question, but I asked it right when the music was about to start, so it's a very good question. And when we come back on the other side of this break, we're going to find out why was Bob Pate invited to Libya by Gaddafi's son, and what did he find out? Back shortly from Chicago.
Great.
From Kennesaw Mountain, Georgia to Kenosha, Wisconsin, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway, 1-800-723-8289. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks for joining us tonight. Art Sear is here. He is the A.W. Clawson Professor of Political Science at the Clawson Center. That is in Carthage College in Kenosha, Wisconsin.
Thanks,
and
Bruce.
He is also author of the book After the Cold War. Spent many years with the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations as well. And I have just learned that one of his students, former students, is Robert Pate, who's our other guest this evening. He is a professor of political science at the University of Chicago, where he is director of the Project on Security and Terrorism. He's co-author of a new book, Cutting the Fuse, The Global Expansion of Suicide Terrorism and How to Stop It. He spent many years teaching at the U.S. Air Force Advanced Air Power Studies and School for Advanced Air Force Studies, and also taught international relations at Dartmouth College. For our friends listening on WNTK in Lebanon, New Hampshire this evening, he has also written several books, Dying to Win, The Strategic Logic of Suicide Terrorism, and Bombing to Win, Air Power and Coercion of War. So one of the country's leading experts on air power, and also author of the book, Why Economic Sanctions Do Not Work. And someday we're going to have you come back and just talk about economic sanctions, because at the beginning of every world crisis, that's usually the first thing they try, economic sanctions. Yep. And as you say, you can tell us why they don't work.
Yep.
Mike in Corpus Christi, we got a lot of callers in Corpus Christi this evening. He's listening to us on Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Go ahead, Mike.
Good evening, Bruce and panel.
Good evening.
I don't think this administration has the slightest idea who these rebels are, who they represent. I think he took his marching orders strictly from the United Nations. We're there without a clue, and this should be a chess game, not checkers. You have to plan ahead. Who is going to take the place of void that you create when Gaddafi or whoever the dictator is that you kick out.
Okay, now that is a perfect. Stay on the line because I want to give you a chance to get a final word. But that your question is a good lead in to the question I asked before the break, which is Bob Pate's been to Libya twice in the last year. He was invited by Saif Gaddafi, Gaddafi's son, to go there.
Mm-hmm.
In the last hour, you said that Saif looked like he was going to be a reforming element, but his rhetoric in recent days indicates that maybe he is as bloodthirsty as his father.
Mm-hmm.
So in answering our question from Corpus Christi, tell us, why were you in Libya, and what were you there for?
Yep.
And what did you see?
I was there because Saif Gaddafi was releasing hundreds of former terrorists that the Libyans had in prison, who, as part of reforms that he was trying to pursue to improve the relationship between ordinary Libyans and the Islamic community. What was at issue was that many of the people who were called Islamic terrorists, they really did want to kill him and his father. They wanted to do it in part because they believed that he was hurting large parts of Libyan society. And I don't just mean in brutal ways such as murdering them and shooting them, but even issues with water, that is at the neighborhood level. One of the things that I saw when I was in Tripoli is that actually quite large parts of Tripoli are without running water. I mean, tens of thousands of people have to live literally from bottled and bottled water, while other parts of Libyan society are actually rich and have malls and so forth. There's a huge division here. Well, Saif Gaddafi, as part of his changes that he was trying to bring, was actually trying to mitigate some of those distances. And as a way to do that was releasing terrorists. And he wanted me to interview them to see if, in fact, they had truly renounced attacking civilians and so forth, which, of course, that they at least said that they did. I never really did believe.
And
that,
how did he know to come to you?
Because I'm one of the leading experts on terrorism.
Suicide terrorism.
Suicide terrorism in particular. And
by the way, for those people who did not hear the broadcast when Bob was on many years ago, he has done a case study of every act of terrorism.
Mm-hmm. Suicide terrorism.
Suicide terrorism in the world since the 1980. Very first incident.
Yep, since 1980, over 2,200 incidents in all. In fact, I hope you don't mind me humbly saying, I'm the person who collected the first complete database of all suicide terrorist attacks around the world. That's something that our government has found incredibly helpful, and it's something that if your listeners will go to the Chicago Project on Security and Terrorism website, you'll see an awful lot of information about that. And so it is not unusual for me to be contacted by the Greek government, the Turkish government, the Israeli government, our government, the British government, and yes, even the Libyan government when issues of terrorism come up.
And is suicide terrorism, is that a derivative of an occupied country?
Yes. What most people think is that suicide terrorism is coming from religion. Well, what I do is study suicide terrorism by collecting all the statistics around the world of who gets the disease and who doesn't get the disease. And what you discover is that there are many, many hundreds of purely secular suicide terrorists, such as the Tamil Tigers in Sri Lanka or the PKK in Turkey. What's really driving suicide terrorism, at least 95% of the time, is foreign occupation. That's why the more we've put large numbers of ground forces overseas, the more we've produced more terrorists than we've killed, and the more we've reduced them, the more we've brought suicide terrorism down.
So, to answer Mike's question about what do we know about the rebels?
Mm-hmm.
I assume you didn't interview them when you were there because the uprising happened after you left.
They didn't exist. But
what do we know, and I want to get everybody's input on this, what do we know about these folks? We know that they're rising up against someone who's a bad guy.
That's right.
That doesn't make them a good guy.
The rebels are a collection of people from about 75% of Libya's 6.5 million people. The main thing we know about the rebels is that a month ago, 75% of Libya's population tried to break away from Gaddafi's grip. It's highly unlikely, that includes many millions of people, it's highly unlikely there were many Islamic terrorists in that group because Gaddafi was in fact imprisoning every Islamic terrorist he could get his hands on and had only released a tiny fraction, tiny number, a few hundred in the last year. So the fact is Gaddafi has spent decades trying to crush Islamic terrorists, and his son was trying to slightly modify this negative relationship. Well, that's what we know.
Artsir, anything to add to that?
And maybe it would be helpful to talk about the wider context. In the last 30 years, we've had a tremendous movement toward representative government and open markets, which really responds to points made by the last two or three callers. In the early 80s, there were one, maybe two democratic governments in Latin America, real democracies. And they were small countries in Central America. Outside of Cuba today, every country in Latin America has some sort of working representation. Even Hugo Chavez in Venezuela has to go to the people. You may not like it, but he faces election. He's had referenda where he's lost. This is a very profound global trend that has something to do with economic development, has something to do with pervasive media, to some extent social media, but I think it's a wider phenomenon of basic literacy, especially for women. Who are remarkably increasing their numbers and influence throughout the Third World. Not so much in elected office in the Middle East and North Africa, but in other parts of Africa. And I think as women become more and more prominent in government, things will continue to move in our direction.
A question I would ask, and then Mike, I'm gonna let you give the final word, but I want to summarize one point, because it seems to me that maybe one of the concerns that Mike might have is if the rebels are rebelling against Gaddafi, because Gaddafi has rounded up and imprisoned radical Islamists,
Yeah. Maybe
the rebels are really upset about that because they themselves are radical Islamists. What's wrong with that thinking?
What's wrong with that thinking is that he has tried to crush Islamic fundamentalism from his country, much the way Saddam Hussein did in Iraq for decades.
But is
that's
that,
why
but
most
is that,
of them left the country.
But is that? But my point is, could that be what the rebels are rebelling against?
Well,
they do not.
Yep.
They maybe he has not made life wonderful for the average person living in Libya. But maybe one of the reasons why they're rising up against this guy is because he has come down so hard on radical Islamist terrorists, which would scare Mike. Mike, am I summarizing your question?
You are exactly right on. I think it's obvious to even the most casual observer that the Islamic Brotherhood is on the march.
Okay.
And they are all over the Middle East. And I'm afraid we may have lit a fuse that we can't put out.
Okay. Bob, speak to my point.
I think that it's just simply in Libyan society, about 10% of the entire population is part of the secret police. That's one of every 10 people. What Gaddafi has done for decades with that large secret police presence is arrest every Islamic fundamentalist he could get. He had about 500 in prison. He released a couple hundred. That's out of 6.5 million people. There's simply no reason to believe that Gaddafi was allowing millions of Islamic fundamentalists to run rampant. And in fact, what he's been doing, he's known as a socialist. He's known as been trying to actually breed his own brand of socialist Islam. And he has pushed his own way of thinking on many of those millions of people. So there's no doubt that there may be a tiny number, and perhaps we'll be surprised. But I think to assume that most of the people in Libya are simply closet Islamic fundamentalists just cuts against what Gaddafi himself was doing.
Okay, Mike, thanks very much for your call. We got callers on the line. We will hear them all when we roll on from coast to coast and border to border every Sunday night. Now in our 30th year on the air, I'm Bruce Dumont from Chicago. From Santa Cruz, California to Skokie, Illinois, you are listening to Beyond the Beltway. Let's go to Calumet City. That's in Illinois, listening to us on WLS this evening, is John. Go ahead, John.
Thank you, Bruce, and thank you very much for demoting this conversation from democracy, since that's not at all what it's about. And thank God for the UN, where we had 2,000 years of war, and for the last 60, it's been peaceful. May I go to my question?
Yes, go ahead.
Isn't this really a power shift from the Sunni to the Shia? In almost all cases, it's primarily Shia tribes, they're uprising, and, it is a land of the rule of revenge, not the rule of law, and it is, they never adopted nation states in their hearts, so we need to recognize these are tribal groups that have a good, legitimate system of governance mm-hmm. that we need to better appreciate. I'd like your comments.
There's a lot to what the caller has to say, at least in the second part about, in the case of Libya, just so we're not confused, there really are no Shia. This is 100% Sunni community, or near 100%. What the caller is mainly putting his finger on is that in tribal society, there is a tribal form of justice. And in fact, one of the problems we're having in Afghanistan is we have centralized power in the central government and tried to turn a society which used to run on a bottom-up tribal system of justice into a top-down system. And that is creating lots and lots of problems in what we're calling nation building. You see, in Afghanistan, there already was a way to sort of run society, but it was bottom-up. Now, the fact of the matter is that doesn't mean we should just simply allow al-Qaeda to have a breeding ground in Afghanistan. Of course not. But what the caller is pointing out is that it really is the case that we need to respect that in many cases, having too tight of a central government, that is imposing a strong central government to try to do our bidding in the short term, can be counterproductive. And in fact, we're starting to see real signs that maybe some folks are actually recognizing that. After all, Barack Obama, what he was really interested in doing was fomenting a transition over time to something that would be produced more from the Egyptian people. I think that's a helpful sign.
Art's here.
Caller, I think, is very wise in pointing out that there are profound cultural differences that are especially important for Americans to appreciate. Insofar as the Shia population is empowered and radical movements grow, that strengthens the hand of Iran in the region. And Richard Nixon pointed out many years ago in one of the good books.
Can anybody give me an informed explanation between the two groups, other than they both come from two brothers of the founder, Muhammad, or something like that?
Right. What they're disagreeing about is the legitimate heirs after Muhammad. So think about this as a little bit like the split between Protestants and Catholics. Catholics were a little bit earlier, and then there was a split where Protestants just simply disagreed with the power of the Pope. That's what you're seeing between Shia and Sunni, except the split is happening earlier, within just the first 70 years after Muhammad died.
We have rich Baptists and Lutherans, but we don't seem to have too many rich Shia except in Iran.
That's exactly right. It turns out that there's, of the 1.4 billion Muslims in the world, only about 10 to 12% are actually Shia. Most of them live in Iran, and then a few in, say, Lebanon, a few in Saudi Arabia, elsewhere.
In Iraq.
Let us go to Cooksville, Tennessee, where Jerry is listening to the broadcast this evening. Nice to hear from the Volunteer State.
Thank you. How are you tonight, Bruce?
Okay.
Hey, well, good. The deal going on right now, it's just like peace has just really exploded across Northern Africa and all across the Middle East. The president said he was going to remake America and transform the world, but I really don't think this is what a lot of people had in mind. And what's going on, just like in Egypt, for instance, the spiritual leader of the Muslim Brotherhood, his name was Kawadari, he was calling for the end of Israel just a few weeks ago. And the Egyptian Airlines, they have removed Israel off their map. And one of the members of the president's inner circle was talking about a massive protection force for Egypt. And now what's going on with Gaza shooting rockets into Israel, and Israel, I'm sure they're going to go in and take the head off the snake before long. When that happens, there'll be calls from, I'm sure, people in the Arab League, in the United Nations, will be calling for no-fly zones and for Israel to stop the atrocities against the citizens in Gaza, and Israel will be protecting themselves. But you have to look at it now. The attacks on Israel has been going on since the day after they became a nation, and all they want to do is have peace, and they are surrounded by countries who want to destroy them. And I don't see anything good coming out of what's going on. All these countries, they will turn against Israel because they're going to have an excuse sooner or later.
Let's get everybody's response because we've only got a short time left. Bob?
I think that the real difference is that today Israel is a much stronger country, very, very capable of defending itself to a great degree. And I just don't believe that what we're facing in the near future is a powerful attack against Israel coming from, say, Egypt.
There is a durable treaty, part of the positive legacy of President Carter. There's a durable treaty between Egypt and Israel, which has survived myriad challenges, including this one. Demographics in the region are against Israel. Mm-hmm. I myself would advocate a more flexible policy by Israel, and I think demographics will force that over time.
That was Art Sear from Carthage College. Bob Pate has been with us from the University of Chicago. And his latest book, again, is...
Cutting the Fuse, The Explosion of Global Suicide Terrorism and How to Stop It.
And also earlier in the broadcast, if you missed it in hour number one, we were joined by Illinois Congressman Adam Kinzinger, a new member of the Republican leadership, the Deputy Republican Whip, and also a captain in the U.S. Air Force Reserve. This broadcast is over for tonight. Our thanks to Tom Veracruz and Dan Dorfman for their assistance in the production of the program. Until next week at this same time, this is Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.